and welcome to EssoTourist podcast You Can't Eat the Sunshine for the week of February 23rd, 2015. Join us this week as we talk with George Red Fox, president of the Downey Conservancy, about the grassroots campaign to save the original Taco Bell restaurant building in Downey. We'll also visit with curators Christina Rice and Wendy Horowitz to learn about their LAPL Central Library exhibit, From Pop to the Pit. LAPL Photo Collection celebrates the LA music scene, 1978 to 1989, so stay tuned.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best. Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Hermina, between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. You can't eat the sunshine, but it's a gold mine of fabulous oddities like Brew Cheers, Dairy, Angela Savvy, Bob's Big Boy, in Downey.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for listening to our podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of February 23rd, 2015. This week, we have our usual two interviews, and this week they are with, first one, George Red Fox. He is president of the Downey Conservancy. He's going to talk about Taco Bell number one. Taco Bell number one is in dire straits. Second, second interview for this episode is with two people.
You never do that.
I did. Christina Rice, Wendy Horowitz. Both are librarians, Central Public Library. Christina is in charge. She is in charge of the photo collections at the Los Angeles Public Library Central location. She's in the history room, fourth floor, basement. Okay. Getting down to the brass tacks there. Wendy is a librarian under her at the photo collection. They've curated a show. Kim, do you want to properly tell the name of the show? Because you were making fun of me earlier for not saying it correctly.
Well, you called it From Pop to Punk, but it's From Pop to the Pit. And the pit does suggest punk, but punk doesn't mean anything to you. I will mention, though, it's really nice having a former On Bunker Hill blogging collaborator, Christina Rice, now in charge of the photo collection at LAPL, because when things get on our radar, like Bob Baker, now deceased, wonderful marionette artisan and educator, deciding to do something with his collection of photographs, we were able to help broker that relationship, and Bob's photos are now at LAPL in the photo collection and are being scanned and should be online in a couple of years. Christina is an amazing scholar and curator of material, and this is a very interesting show that anyone who likes music of almost any genre from the late 70s through the 80s will be interested to see.
Kim, I'm so sorry. Listening to you talk, I'm now under the impression that this photo show we're talking about is about Bob Baker's marionettes puppets.
No, there's no puppets. I don't think there. Well, actually, there might be a puppet in that Dickies photo.
Kim? I need you. I asked you to tell us the name of their show, and then you went totally off, and now everyone thinks this is a photo exhibit about puppets, and it's not. Would you please tell us the title of the show and the subject of the title?
From Pop to the Pit, LAPL Photo Collection celebrates the Los Angeles music scene, 1978 to 1989. Not included in that title is that the photos are all from the Herald Examiner collection.
Thank you, Kim. Okay, I think we can get on with the podcast now, and we can leave general musings to the appropriate spot at the end of this introduction. So, Kim, you're the Pishka maven. Could you please tell us about the Pishka?
Well, I don't know. After I did such a bad job with that, maybe no one wants to give us anything.
Very good. Okay, so
come on, I'll do the Pishka. If I don't do the Pishka, then I can't move forward. I'm that way. Richard, thanks for reminding me we have a tip jar. It's digital. It's associated with this podcast. If you like what we do, and we hope that you do, and I'm not faking it, I really hope you do, you're encouraged to occasionally consider throwing something into that digital tip jar to help us with the costs of our excursions across the Southland looking for fascinating people to talk to, for you to listen to. Like, for instance, going down to Downey, where we met Brian Kaiser and ate a dinner at Bob's Big Boy. So that's all you need to know. You can find it on the podcast page. We never consider it obligatory, but we are always grateful for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. Okay, we need to get into the closely watched train section now. So Kim, I really want to keep this on task, and the task is simply to convey this information. There's not a lot of commentary to it because it's just really sad, and we don't really know a lot more. So what is it you need to tell everyone?
That's why I'm a little rattled today. The King Edward's Saloon, the King Eddie, the oldest Skid Row bar, remaining Skid Row bar at the corner of 5th and Los Angeles, which has been under the ownership of Acme and Johnny Valenti and his team, and recently took on some partners, unfortunately has been put on the market. And it's not just the upstairs bar, it's also the unfinished speakeasy in the basement, something that you discovered, Richard, some years ago, and that has been a very, very interesting location to a lot of people who are interested in L.A. history. So it's the old bar upstairs at the corner of 5th and Los Angeles, very important location, very important part of that community, and also the basement, which is written about by John Fonte, the wonderful L.A. author in Ask the Dust.
Thank you, Kim. So that, okay, good. All right.
Well, I want you to talk about it.
Okay, So, we're going to see Johnny in a couple of days, and I look forward to talking to Johnny, and I'm really sad. I'm really sad. My role is to be a witness, as we all are. We just witness downtown as it goes through whatever cycle, whatever incredibly complicated, vicious cycle it's currently in, and it's going to go through it, and we're just going to witness it, and that's it.
And for anyone who doesn't know, if you've been to the King Eddie a couple of years ago, you probably remember it as a bar that was just kind of filled with people who live in the hotels in the immediate vicinity. There were always people in the King Eddie. You could always find someone to talk to. Under the new ownership, it stopped opening at 6 a.m., and it's become more of an evening venue. And we haven't spent as much time there, and we've been there on a few tours, but I don't have a strong sense of what the culture of the King Eddie has been. But I know they've made some changes. The bar got a little smaller recently. The smoking room became a dart room. And, you know, it's still there. It is on the market, but who knows what'll happen. Go down, enjoy the King Eddie while we still can, while you still can. And maybe we'll see you there and have a beer.
Okay. And I look forward to talking to Johnny, who's very good to us. That is the salient aspect I want everyone to take away from this, is Johnny Valenti is a mensch. And it's great working with him.
Yeah, and when you say good to us, what you mean is, you know, if we want to bring a group of people in to see that historical speakeasy and talk about it, you know, we've been welcomed in many times, and Johnny has a real passion for the history of the place, and this must be really hard for him, and I'm very sorry it hasn't worked out as planned.
Okay, so we're going to stay focused. Okay. Okay, so Kim, so Union Oil is an old Los Angeles-based oil company. William Pereira, with his partner Charles Luckman in 1958, built Union Oil headquarters in what is Crown Hill, basically at 6th, just west of the Harbor Freeway. They put that in just after the freeway went in. So that was Union Oil headquarters, and then about...
Is it west of the freeway?
It's just, yes, it's west. It's in Crown Hill, Kim. And then about just a little less than 20 years later, William Pereira was commissioned to design a Union Oil 76 gas station in Beverly Hills with a Hypar shell, this saddle. So do you want to talk about that, Kim? Because you like 76 stations and their balls.
Actually, the station was originally going to be part of LAX, which is interesting when you think of it in terms of the theme building that is the central architectural feature of the airport. But somehow it ended up moving to Beverly Hills, and you've seen it. You've seen it on record covers. You've seen it driving by. It's a very distinctive structure. And, you know, until recently, Beverly Hills was sort of a black hole for preservation. Mansionization problems really began there. A lot of wonderful old homes getting torn down, and these awful boxes going up in their stead. And there's been a pushback from the local community that does care about the history and the legacy of old Beverly Hills. And so they've started to create a list of protected buildings and protectable architects, which is a really good idea. And one of the buildings that has recently gotten this landmark designation nod is the Jack Kolker 76 station, which is what you were just mentioning, this wonderful high par, this beautiful soaring wing
saddle
under which you can fill her up, kiddo, so go and have a look. And of course, I am happy to report that is one of the 76 stations that retains a ball-shaped sign. It is a red sign because of the campaign that we entered into when we first were together, you and I, Richard, when we fought to save the 76 ball. They were all being destroyed, and ConocoPhillips, after a year of a lot of pressure from very amusing newspaper articles, all of which had balls in the headlines worldwide, the British especially like their balls, they said, oh, we made a terrible mistake. People really do love this 1962 Ray Pederson design created for the Seattle World's Fair. We're going to keep it, but we're going to rebrand it in our ConocoPhillips colors. So there's a red ball there now. Not orange, but a ball is a ball, and you can go and visit it. And when you do, please wave to it for us.
Okay, good. So, Kim, we're gonna start to talk about the Union Rescue. We're gonna start to talk about things around and about the Union Rescue Mission. Union Rescue Mission has been around since for about 122 years now. They're currently at 6th and San Pedro, and we'll get to that in a minute. Their second location, 1924 to 1994, was at 226 South Main. That is one lot south of the former St. Vibiana's Cathedral, now known as Vibiana's.
Just Vibiana.
Vibiana. Thank you.
Yeah.
And you passed me a link just yesterday that a development company has been cleared, permitted, been given all the permits to develop a little over 200 units, residential units, on the lot of the former Union Rescue Mission. Former Union Rescue Mission comprised two buildings. It comprised the Swanfelt Building, which was 1913, and the Oddfellows Building, which is 1908, I think, 1909. Nathan never actually did his blog post on the Oddfellows Building, so
He will.
So that's not seared into my brain, the date. So the Union Rescue Mission took over the Oddfellows building. The Swanfelt Building was their home immediately when they moved in, because of course City Hall was built, and in 24 they were thrown out of their location on Main Street at First, which is now City Hall Lawn. So Mr. Swanfelt sold them half of his building where they built awnings in 24, and they moved in 26. And then Mr. Swanfelt left the second northern part of the building in 28, and they moved to 25th and Figueroa to manufacture awnings, and the URM took over that. And then by the beginning of World War II, they'd purchased the Oddfellows Building so they could move the Victory Service Club into it to deal with all the servicemen. So, and all of this, of course, was demolished within about a week in 1996, middle of 1996, when, after 10 years, the Community Redevelopment Agency, the Office of the Mayor and City Council, and the Union Rescue Mission agreed that was no longer a good location for them. And after a 10-year capital campaign, they built a new structure at 6th and St. Peter, where it is now. And that's where they are, and this lot sat vacant for almost 30 years, yeah. So 96, 10, 20, oh, 20, 22 years, thank you. Sorry. So now there's someone's going to build on it, and they expressed interest in the vibrancy and history of the neighborhood, and So I've called their chief operating officer and let them know that there's a lot there that they didn't mention in the interview they gave.
Well, it wasn't an interview so much. I mean, there was an interview, but the Downtown News, you know, reported on how exciting it was that this vacant lot was finally going to get built on, and they were talking about the history of the site, and all they were talking about was Saint Bibiana, which is, it's such a weird lack of context for that corner. Well, not corner, that block. It's in the middle of the block, and I understand that things have been knocked down, and it's hard to land on your feet and look around and understand that it wasn't just a cathedral sitting there by itself, surrounded by open fields. But it was an incredibly vibrant, important block, and the Union Rescue Mission's presence there, just south of the cathedral, is so core to the understanding of Old Main Street, which was really the core of old Los Angeles. And directly across the street, you had the Penny Arcade and the Tattooist and the movie theater and the restaurants and just so much activity and energy. It is a great, great block, and a block that we often bring people to and sort of revive through word pictures. And I hope that when this new structure goes up, there'll be some way of keeping that history alive, because, of course, we have often stood in that parking lot and brought old history to life. And, you know, when buildings go up, it gets to be a little harder to talk about a lack of a building, unless you maybe do something a little more visual and prominent. So who knows? Maybe they'll open a little cafe called the Victory Service Club downstairs. That'd be neat.
We're going to have a nice talk with them. I think they're going to be a nice presence at our next screening of Scrap and Steal and URM Walking Tour. I have this funny feeling that they're going to be a nice presence. Okay, we need to keep moving on. So, Kim, the last closely watched train is we've actually had words over this watched train now three times, and you only sent me the link 2 days ago. So I'm going to let you introduce it, because I really don't want it to not get mentioned. Mm-hmm. It's the Airbnb town at 6th and San Pedro, which is across the street from the URM.
Yeah, if you're on the internet, you may have seen this link going around. Someone is renting out an Airbnb tent on Skid Row for $10 a night, and the rental comes with the services of a concierge who's sort of a street dude who will help you, you know, figure out the lay of the land. And I kind of felt like the various blogs that picked this link up, and it was taken offline pretty quickly, but people scraped it and copied it and talked about it. I think a lot of people I think people took it really in a very reactionary way, and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe someone who lives in a loft is renting out a tent on Skid Row. I read it as someone writing a very clever piece meant to get people talking about what life is like on Skid Row and what it means to be in a tent on the street in this rapidly changing downtown where, you know, you have the moneyed classes and the poverty stricken and the mentally ill and the desperately needy and a bunch of politicians running around talking about how they're going to save everyone and fix it all by the end of the year. And, you know, I thought it was a provocative and interesting thing, and I don't think it's a real $10 a night Airbnb.
Is Tom the concierge?
Right. We were at this. We went to one of the debates about CD14, which encompasses Skid Row, the council district, and apparently a guy named Tom was one of the more influential people that Jose Huizar has met in recent days. Not a donor, who came up, who was approached on Skid Row by the team of the Healthy Streets people, and no one had asked him up until that moment what he needed. But once he was asked, he had a lot to say, and he got all the help he needed. So here's to Tom.
He's not the concierge. See, I think when I read that LAist blog post you sent me about the tent rental, I think everyone should have been tipped off when the person renting out the tent at media inquiries said, no, I'm sorry, I don't have any openings until 2016, and it's February of 2015. I really feel like...
Well, you know, it's all the German tourists there. Yeah.
Okay, so Kim, we're gonna move on into... we're done with closely watched trains. Oh, God, I'm so upset about the King Eddie. All right, so... we're going to move on to upcoming events, and again, I have to tip my hat to Johnny Valenti, because the Lava Sunday Salon has been relaunched, and it's been relaunched at Library Bar entirely to the good graces of Johnny Valenti. God bless him. And so we're just back in the thick of it. We've got some salons coming up that I want to announce. But before we get to March's salon, which is the last Sunday of March, I want you just to call out the Lava Forensic Science Seminar we have Sunday, March 15.
Sure. I'm kind of proud of the title. Hot Lead and Hot Leads. Yeah. This one is about two really interesting subjects in contemporary forensic science investigation. Hot Lead would refer to ballistics and all the things you can learn from a bullet that emerges from a gun. And we'll be working with Michael I. Kelly, who does a lot of very interesting ballistics analysis, including the Pat Tillman investigation in Afghanistan. He did that recreation. And he'll be walking us through some real case studies and showing exactly what evidence was found that helped to solve cases. So that's going to be really cool. And then Nick Guskos in part two is going to be showing us what it looks like to investigate an actual homicide behind bars in the county jail. So these are real investigators sharing real casework. And if you're interested in forensic science, not as it appears on TV, but how it's really practiced in the lab and in the courtroom, you're going to get everything you need right there at the Cal State LA Forensic Science Center.
Okay, let me just add a couple things about each talk. So Mike Kelly is obviously being a forensic investigator for the Pentagon. Obviously is exceptionally well qualified. He will be, in addition to a lot of actual real life casework as examples for his talk, he's going to be bringing a lot of show and tell. Okay, and we're going to be breaking into labs right after Mike's talk. And people are going to get a chance to really, really get up close and get their hands dirty with a lot of his show and tell of the ballistic forensics. So, and that's good. And also, Nick is, and the other speaker, Nick, is also incredibly gifted. Homicide investigation within the sheriff's department's correctional facilities is a real niche. And we're really blessed to have Nick talk about it. It's a subject of dear interest to me. So I'm really grateful that he's going to take us down this path. And so Kim, do you want to tell us about the Lava Salon in March, which is just 2 weeks late, 2 Sundays later?
I could totally do that because I'm so excited. It's Nathan Marsak who kind of reintroduced us, Richard, a very important core person to our lives. And Nathan is the Lava Visionary of the Year, 2015. You know, we don't recuse ourselves. We pick our visionaries. We think that Nathan's doing some extraordinary work in his architectural research, and so he's going to come and he's going to talk to us about the Richardsonian Romanesque, these wonderful red sandstone castles of early Los Angeles, almost all of which are gone. There's one or two small remnants and even a building or two remaining. And Nathan's Lava Visionary of the Year lecture is about this really extraordinary lost architectural legacy of Los Angeles. And judging by the last salon, our debut in the new location, these things are very popular, so you definitely want to RSVP soon if you want to get a spot.
Okay. Good. Good, 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 good. All right. Just because I posted it, because I wanted to get it, in the flyer for last weekend's Paul Kudnaris' talk, Lava Salon. We put it out there April 26th. Joan Job Smith will be talking. She'll be coming up from Long Beach, and we're going to have a very, okay, not too freeform, but this is definitely the new bar for these salons is a little more interactive, a little less formal, and so we're going to break her talk up into a couple bite-sized chunks. Some poetry. She's going to recite some of her poetry. Maybe a Charles Bukowski poem.
That'd be nice.
I don't want to put, but you know, she's going to talk about her memoir. The main focus of her talk will be her memoir, Tales of an Ancient Go-Go Girl. This is a memoir about working in some of the toughest spots in Los Angeles County in the mid 1960s. Really, really tough spots. This is a memoir about not just being a go-go dancer in mafia-run nightclubs or bars, but also her marriage, which was a very, very abusive marriage, which is really the core kernel of her memoir, and out of that comes her writing. She enrolls in a master's program at Cal State Long Beach. She's befriended by Charles Bukowski, who is just so deeply impressed with the pain and shit she has come out of. That they take on a lifelong friendship, and so she's just gonna go down the road of all of this go-go dancing and the voice within you, which is great, and Charles Bukowski and how much beer he actually drank.
And I think that Joan is doing such important work because, I mean, obviously there were hundreds of women doing this work in Los Angeles and all across the country. Well, there are a lot of bars, there are a lot of women, but, you know, their stories remain completely untold. These are not the kind of people who went home and thought, maybe I'll make a memoir out of this, let me take some notes. Joan is very unique for being as smart and as gifted as she was and living the life she did and being so cognizant of what was happening around her. I think that this is a really important lost bit of urban LA history, and I'm so excited that she's going to come and talk at the Salon.
Right, and just to close this thread, which she'll get into, so, you know, she's in the writing program. Charles Bukowski has, you know, taken her into his bosom, and they're talking on the phone every night for hours. He's contributing poetry to her journals. She's just really very supportive. And then her advisor said, "Well, you can't write about being a go-go dancer. You can't do that. That's not what you write. That's not a proper topic." So really, really only because Bukowski was the, I think, one, Bukowski's literary lion status, I think, had a lot to do with giving Joan that extra little inch of traction in her psyche that kept her on this path. So.
And yet she only just published the book. So, you know, these inhibitions from writing teachers, don't listen to these jerks. What have they ever written? Ugh. Kill them all.
So we're super excited. Joan is one of my favorite people in the world, and I just have to say this because it broadcasts to the widest audience. So the reason you should genuflect at the sound of her name. You should genuflect when you hear her name. But she's the one that's kept all the old girlfriends in touch, all the Bukowski girlfriends in touch, and that's no mean feat. As a conscious effort on her part, and I really appreciate that because it gives us a lot of context to the Los Angeles underground in the mid-60s through the mid-70s, and it's really important. So we need to move on.
Yes,
we need to move on to our interview. So we're gonna interview George first about Taco Bell. So we'll introduce our second interview first. Second interview is Christina and Wendy, and they are they're librarians at the Los Angeles Public Library. They're both Christina's in charge of the photo collection. Wendy is a librarian under her with the photo collection, and so they're going to talk about their show, From Pop to the Pit. LAPL Photo Collection celebrates the Los Angeles music scene 1978 to 1989. I got the title right. Good.
You read it.
I did read it.
Kim.
I absolutely read it. So they're great. It's I rarely interview two people. They're perfect. They're a perfect duo interview. Quickly, let me get through some fun filled facts. Two or three things I know about each of them. Christina is in charge of the photo collection at the Los Angeles Public Library. It's a serious position for a serious woman. Who really kicks ass, in my opinion. Christina has written a book, written a biography, Anne Dvorak, Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel. She's done a lot of Salon on this. It's a great book. She's writing comics at the moment. I think one of her projects is a comic, so we'll...
Yeah, she's in, like, the most successful writer of My Little Pony comics there is, and if you've got a four-year-old girl, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So that's Chris. A little bit, two or three things I know about Christina. Now, Wendy Horowitz. Wendy is a photo librarian. So that's concerns herself with just the photo collection at LAPL, and taking direction from Christina on this. I'm going to include in the links a really great blog post Wendy did about the battle for Hollywood, Stephen Anthony. Siege of his house to evict him, and
such an interesting case. I mean, there's been nothing but trouble every time anyone in Los Angeles has tried to create a museum of Hollywood history, and this continues. But gunfire, only at the Stephen Anthony siege.
Okay, so far. So that's our second interview. Our first interview, which we'll get into now, is with George Red Fox. He's president of the Downey Conservancy. He is a member of Downey Historical. He is a tried, true, dyed-in-the-wool Downey resident and historian. He's great. We went down a couple weeks ago and did a bunch of interviews with him about some preservation crises, and the Taco Bell is the most serious one, so we're pushing it out into the queue as soon as we could. And this interview is about the original Taco Bell and on Firestone Boulevard. And so let's take it away with my interview with George. George, I'm here with you. We're in the 7,000 block of Firestone Boulevard in Downey. We're across the street from my least favorite site in the world, a construction fence with green mesh around it. And on the other side of that fence is the original Taco Bell. So I need you to properly introduce yourself and tell us about the unfolding saga of this iconic fast food restaurant.
Hi, my name is George Red Fox. I'm from the Downey Conservancy and also from the Downey Historical Society. I'm the president of the Downey Conservancy and a member at the Downey Historical Society.
Okay, good. All right. Taco Bell. It's the original one. 20 by 20. 400 square foot, Adobe-esque taco shack. What's happening?
Well, right now it's in danger of possibly being demolished, which a lot of people are not real happy about. However, we are hoping that there might be some light at the end of the tunnel for saving this building.
Okay. Now, a little backstory. This isn't just any Taco Bell. This is the what is unique about this Taco Bell?
This is the first Taco Bell in the country. Taco Bell number one. So we are standing right across the street from that building.
Okay, good. All right, that's serious. Okay, give us a little background. The property owners want to clear the property. They said they have some redevelopment ideas. So what are we looking at here? What's on the table? You're involved in this. What are some solutions that you're looking at?
Okay, so the property owner, from what we understand, he would like to clear the property. He, however, is willing to work with whoever wants to, you know, try to preserve it. So we have maybe a 6 to 9 month timeline where we would like to either get it moved or, you know, taken at least off of that location where we could, you know, get it and give it a new life, I guess you could say, a new existence. I guess he probably just wants to redevelop the property just so it's, you know, got better use. It's fairly underutilized if we look across there now. There's not a whole lot over there, just kind of sitting. So if we can get this place moved, it's roughly a 20 by 20 building, 400 square feet. It's not very big. If we could get it lifted up onto the back of a truck and move it to another location with a new piece of land, a new owner, hopefully, you know, maybe Taco Bell might want to do it. Downey Conservancy might also be interested in, you know, helping with the move and all that kind of stuff, too. That's, you know, what we're trying to get done. I don't know if we would be able to actually run the building, but Taco Bell would be a good candidate for, you know, possibly, you know, moving, restoring, and getting this place saved, which would be, you know, really great.
George, let's get to some good words, encouraging words. Give us a little more detail. You've talked to Taco Bell.
Yes, we have.
Give us, you got to put it out there for it to happen. So put out there, this is all positive, put out there what you've been talking about. Give us some details, because it is encouraging.
Okay. So, you know, Taco Bell has contacted us at the Downey Conservancy, which is really, really awesome that they did. We've been talking with some of the corporate people down there. There is interest from Taco Bell of possibly saving and moving this building, which is very, very great news for us. There are, I guess you could say, corporate entities that would like to help with possibly a move and restoration. And there's also franchisees that might possibly be interested in possibly using it as a, you know, gift store, historical museum, whatever it might be. So there are possibilities out there, and we're looking, really looking forward to working with Taco Bell. If you are around the area, and please hashtag Save Taco Bell to your Twitters and your Instagrams and all that kind of stuff, because it's, you know, those hashtags go directly to Taco Bell. They set that hashtag up. So Save Taco Bell is their hashtag. Corporate put that out. Okay. So we're encouraged.
Okay. We've talked to you before about two other restaurants in Downey, McDonald's and Bob's Big Boy, formerly Harvey's Broiler. I think it's safe to say at this point there is a model for what we're talking about here. And before we sign off, if you could just refresh everyone's memory of this whole notion of franchise, corporate partnership to save an historic fast food restaurant in Downey, just so we can take that in and say, oh my gosh, this might work here too.
So yeah, there are two models here in Downey as far as restoration and museum, and one of them is over at the original McDonald's here in Downey. The other one is Bob's Big Boy, which is formerly Harvey's Broiler. Harvey's Broiler was built from basically the ground up after an illegal demolition. A great place to go if you have not had a burger there. You're going to want to go there and check this place out because it is very googie, it is very mid-century, and if you like that kind of stuff, you're going to be right at home inside Bob's Big Boy. As far as the original McDonald's here in Downey, California, that place is another great googie piece of architecture here in town. That has a museum attached, I guess you could say, to the property. And it's really cool because Corporation put that together, the McDonald's Corporation. And what's cool about it is you can go in there, you can see old menus, you can see old pieces of equipment that they used to use inside that, I think inside of actually that location. And lots of pictures and history and memorabilia and all kinds of great stuff to go on there. So lots of models here in town. If we could just get Taco Bell Corporation and have them help out to get this place saved.
And a franchisee.
And a franchisee to maybe operate a museum out of that building or something, it would be awesome. Just really a great opportunity here in Downey, I think.
Okay. You did it. You did it. We're going to... when we publish this, we're, of course, going to push it through social media with the hashtag Save Taco Bell. Please remind us of your positions in the Historic and Preservation Societies here in Downey, and we're going to thank you for talking to us again.
Okay, once again, my name is George Red Fox. I'm the president of the Downey Conservancy, and I'm also a member at the Downey Historical Society.
George, thank you so much, and Save Taco Bell.
Thank you. Save Taco Bell.
My name is Erin Geddes, and I'm here in Riverside City Hall, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Christina, Wendy, I'm here with you. We're in the history room of the Los Angeles Public Library, and I want both of you, Christina, you first, introduce yourself. And Wendy, when you're done introducing, you're going to tell us why I'm talking to both of you here on the fourth floor.
Sounds great. My name's Christina Rice. I am the senior librarian of the Los Angeles Public Library Photo Collection.
I'm Wendy Horowitz. I am a photo librarian for the Los Angeles Public Library Photo Collection.
Perfect. And so I'm talking to both of you today because, Wendy?
Well, we have an exhibit that will be on view and the History Department, Lower Level 4, called From Pop to the Pit, the Los Angeles Public Library's Photo Collection Celebrates the Los Angeles Music Scene, 1978 to 1989. It's a long title.
And a very good show. So let's roll up our sleeves and jump in. Christina, we got a bunch of photos here. Tell us about motivations behind the show, what you're excited about. We want to hear it all.
Yeah, well, Wendy is the main curator of the exhibit, so she's our Herald Examiner archivist. The show is comprised mainly of photos from our Herald Examiner photo collection. We do have a few from local photographer Gary Leonard, who's been donating photos to us for years. So Gary unknowingly filled in a lot of gaps for this exhibit. So Wendy will be able to address, you know, motivations and what inspired her. She came to me with the idea after she'd been working with the Herald collection for a few months. I'm a music fan. I always have been. I was a rocker when I was a kid. So when she brought it up, I said, oh, yeah, how can I say no to letting her curate a music exhibit? So I was really excited. I was really excited to have heavy metal on the wall. And it does. Wendy, I don't know if Wendy was quite as excited to have metal on the wall, but I think we worked well together. Personally, I'm very excited about the Motley Crue photo. When we were putting together the exhibit, or when Wendy was, she was showing me photos, and just a lot of, you know, well-known bands, not so well-known bands were there. Motley Crue wasn't there. And I said, Wendy, as the boss, I'm pulling rank. If we don't have Motley Crue, we don't have an exhibit. Because love them or hate them, they were a huge part of the music scene. Like, they launched the metal music scene in the early 80s. And so couldn't find Motley in the Herald. And so I called up Gary Leonard. I said, Gary, did you ever shoot Motley Crue? He said, you know, I did. I shot them sometime for the Los Angeles Recorder. Oh, what was it? The Reader. Thank you. Thank you, Wendy. The Los Angeles Reader. And he goes, if you can help me figure out when I shot them, I'll find the photo in storage. And so I was able to use my incredible knowledge of Shout at the Devil era Motley Crue. We pinpointed when he took the photo of them. He dug up his negatives, made a contact sheet, let us pick a couple that we wanted. And that is why we have Motley Crue in the exhibit. And I am so very excited to have them there.
Perfect. Perfect. Wendy, it's your turn. Where did this start to gel in your brain?
Actually, I was part of my job is filing away photos, pulling photos for patron requests for images that have not been digitized yet, a lot of digging. And as I was digging, I came across these boxes. One was, I think the label was From Chic to Dukes, or from Cheap Trick to or AC/DC to Cheap Trick. That's what it was, because it was in alphabetical order. And I thought, okay, I just stumbled upon the music boxes. And I, being new in the department, and Christina will agree, I used to run into her office for every little thing that I found exciting. Now, she has been in the department for years. So I think that maybe I was just, it's just that enthusiasm one has when they first come to this department. I think everybody who visits the department is a little blown away at first, but Christina, who'd been here for a while, is thinking, okay, that's great, Wendy, that's great. But
only if you have Motley Crue.
Well, I raced into her office when I found the boxes and said, do you think that maybe, wouldn't it be great to do something with bands? And a couple of months later, actually, it was not even that much longer later. You said, how'd you like to do that idea that you had? And so I think that I just dove right in. And as I was digging through the boxes, I found myself dragging my feet into her office looking very forlorn. I don't think we have enough photos. I can't find enough photos. And then I realized that in my mind, I was envisioning exactly what ultimately, I'm glad we did not do. Originally, I was envisioning a very biased view of Los Angeles music that adhered to specific genres and acknowledged certain, you know, types of rock music. And when I realized I couldn't find enough photos that fell under a certain category, and then Christina said, I really hope that you're not, you know, omitting heavy metal. And I have to admit that I did pass on a lot of heavy metal photos that went into a different pile. I had this epiphany, which is, this is exactly what we should be doing. We have to have an exhibit with absolutely everything, with no bias, with no preference. Nothing is hipper or cooler than anything else. Everybody's going to share the spotlight, and they're going to be arranged in kind of like a shuffled deck order of, you know, household names next to the obscure, you know? No particular order. Everybody's a star.
Although I did...
Christina Rice here.
Christina Rice, anybody who knew me back in the day knew that I was completely obsessed with Guns N' Roses. And so I did tell Wendy, you are going to put Guns N' Roses at the end of the exhibit. They will close it out. So sometimes it is nice to be queen.
Wendy is interjecting. Christina did send me up to the negative warehouse, or there was a donation of thousands of negatives with the request to find Guns N' Roses. And because she knows so much about Guns N' Roses, she knew when they played Los Angeles. When I finally found the negatives, I was covered in grime. I mean, though, I remember running up to you, but I was a little exhausted because I'd literally been digging through the grimiest boxes with dust and old dirt and these negatives from the Guns N' Roses, the full roll of film, not just the one image, but the roll of film that the photographer took when they were at the MTV Music Awards. And I think they were also there was a concert in there too, right?
This is Christina. No, there is no Guns N' Roses concert in the Herald collection. They're only just photos of them announcing nominees for the MTV Music Awards in '89. Admittedly, pretty weak photos, but it's all we have. And there was, again, without Guns N' Roses, there would be no exhibit.
Okay. I remember now, it was Rat. It was Rat that I found. That's what it was. Well, anyway, I was rooting for my friends.
Okay, your friends, Wendy, are?
Friends in a couple of different bands. The 3 o'clock, Michael Quercio is a good friend, and in the band Red Cross. Very, very, they're my oldest friends in Los Angeles. They were my first friends ever upon moving to Los Angeles. And I was worried that Christina might look at the pictures and say, who are they? But instead, she said, this is a fantastic picture. And I was very excited because she shared the same attitude as me. If the picture is great, it goes in the exhibit. We're not going to try to qualify it with how famous are they and how relevant are they. They're just as relevant as anyone else because they're having fun, they're being themselves, and Los Angeles is about freedom.
Yeah.
You know, being just doing, not having to wear a uniform, like a black leather jacket, torn jean kind of Ramones look, but you can just be yourself in Los Angeles and create your own identity and have it be rock and roll in true spirit of the sense.
Perfect. Okay, let's see who wants to take this one. I want to do two things. I want to walk through some of the photos. One of you gets to do, well, you both can do, pick a couple. Do either of you want to talk about the clubs, the locations in which some of these photos were shot? Not all of them, I'm looking to you, Wendy. Not an encyclopedic taxonomy of the clubs, but do you just want to pick? We've got.
Why don't you talk a little bit about Lucy Snow?
Yes, because she can do that. I would need to be able to look on the back and see where. I don't have the captions in front of me.
So let's talk about Lucy Snow.
Well, you know, once we were researching the photos, we found that suddenly, when it came to the bands that played in the smaller clubs, all of the photos were dated 1988 or 89, which was puzzling because a lot of these bands, such as the Dickies, had been around since the 70s. Why aren't there pictures from the 70s and the 80s of bands that made their name during that time? And my husband knows one of the photographers, Todd Everett, through, you know, from
his social circles. And so I got in touch with Todd Everett, and he gave me an interview over the phone, which didn't exactly explain that much, but he filled in some of the blanks. Basically, Todd Everett worked for the Herald throughout, you know, a good chunk of time. He was there for more than 10 years, and he covered the big venues. He would go to the country club is moderately big. It's not, you know, a small club, but also, you know, major arenas. And he said, you know, I really hated going into the small clubs. They were hot. They were dark. You had to use a flash. You were being jostled around by the pit, the mosh pit. You were, you'd have to stake out a spot in front of the stage and wait around for the band to come on. It was just a drag. And so I thought to myself, that explains it. That's why, you know, when we have bands like Black Flag or X, those are portraits done out of doors, done in the daylight. Even Social Distortion is a portrait done on the streets of L.A. It's not a club photo. So who did take these pictures? And, you know, we flipped over the back, and that's where the, you know, stamp would be for the photographer. And we found out that Lucy Snow was really the only photographer who went into the clubs. Luckily, Lucy, who's a sweetheart, she gave me a great interview over the phone. She now lives in Oregon, and she was just terrific. She told us a lot about what we already expected, which was that towards the end of the Herald's time, they didn't really go into the clubs until Lucy and a guy by the name of Gregory Sandow, I think his name was. He was from the Village Voice, and he came to the Herald, and Lucy was a freelance photographer. She wasn't a staff photographer, but Greg was, I believe, on staff doing a column called Night Flash, which is a whole other story. Night Christina knows what I'm talking about. And so he and Lucy would go out, and they would go to the Coconut Teaser, to Raji's, to the lingerie, the club lingerie. They would go to the anti-club. They would go to the Cafe de Grand and places like, or Cafe might have been closed at that point, but they went to those. That's right, Gary Leonard took the Cafe de Grand pictures, but they would go to those clubs, and they didn't get scared off by, you know, the lack of ventilation and the lack of light. They used flash. Lucy was a little self-conscious about the fact that she used a flash, and she was sort of apologizing to me over the phone. Oh, I used a flash. I guess that's some sort of a sin when you're a photographer, that you want to, you know, rely on natural light or rely on your expertise on aperture and speed and everything. But the photos are here, thanks to Lucy. They are in our collection, and now they're on the wall.
Perfect. Yeah. Christina.
To interject, you know, for us who work with these photos day in and day out, it's as much about the photographers as it is the bands in the photos. And so we're happy to shine a spotlight on somebody like Lucy Snow. You know, there are photographers up on the wall who are no longer alive. This incredible photo of Eazy-E by Steve Grayson, our X photos by Ann Knutson, who passed away recently. So we love shining a spotlight on the photographers. We have an amazing photo of Eddie Van Halen. I think he's at the Forum. So we have the clubs, but we also have the bigger venues represented. It's this great photo of him just jumping in the air. It's just Eddie surrounded by black. And Paul Chin, who shot the photo, and he's up with the San Francisco Chronicle now, I know it's a personal favorite photo of his, because when we had a group of Herald photographers do a discussion here a couple years back. That was one that he specifically asked me to find in the collection. And once we were doing that, it was a no-brainer that Edward Van Halen jumping by Paul Chin would be included in the exhibit. So, and we had a huge opening night in January. About 250 people showed up. And we had quite a few of the Herald photographers. And so it's really nice to know that their names are getting out there, and that, you know, all of our local history researchers are, I think, have really become familiar with these photographers.
Perfect. Okay, let's bring this on home. Okay. Wendy, hold on a second. Christina, do you want to, just in passing, mention the nonprofit that is loosely associated with this too?
So the exhibit is in part sponsored by Photo Friends. They're a nonprofit group that supports the photo collection, mainly through programming. They also provide, there's our wonderful descriptive didactics that hang up next to the exhibits. Those are designed by Amy Inouye, who's our Photo Friends president, paid for by Photo Friends. We have wonderful selection of postcards that if you come down, look at the exhibit, there's free postcards. We have that great photo of Motley Crue, Black Flag, the Bangles, and Eazy-E. Those are all paid for by Photo Friends, as well as some other promotional materials. And we have an exhibit catalog. So there's only room for 31 photos on the wall in the history department. And despite, Wendy's initial concern that we wouldn't be able to dig up enough, we actually put together an exhibit catalog that has, I think, about 100 photos. Wow. And so that catalog is available for purchase in the library store here at Central, or you can go onto Amazon and just search for From Pop to the Pit. It should come up.
We'll put a link on the website page.
Excellent. Thank you. And proceeds from the sales of that book directly benefit Photo Friends. And to go along with the exhibit, we've been scheduling programming. We had four music photographers who we signed up. Our first one, Jenny Lenz, already happened. But coming up in the near future, we have Gary Leonard in March. Ed Culver is going to be in April. And then rocker metal photographer extraordinaire Niels Lozauer, whose photos were hanging on my wall as a kid. He will be here in June talking about his photos.
Perfect. Remind us the date which this is going to run through, and then Wendy's going to bring us on home with a personal anecdote.
Yeah, so From Pop to the Pit is going to be on display in the History and Genealogy Department at Central Library during regular business hours through June 28th.
Christina, thank you, and then we're gonna wrap this up with Wendy.
Great, thank you so much, Richard.
Okay, Wendy, take us on home. Give us your favorite anecdote that's just you.
I don't know about an anecdote, but I feel like I need to say something.
Yeah,
say something? There have been some. There has been some criticism, which we knew there would be, towards this exhibit, because music has a way of dividing people as well as bringing them together. And
people are unhappy with the show.
Well, I would accept that if it were based on knowledge of what our mission was, but people are really confused. The people who have taken issue with the exhibit, who have criticized it, seem to be under the impression that we're just collecting images through Pinterest and we're right-clicking and saving. And they're saying, why isn't this guy up there? Why isn't this band up there? Obviously, the curators of this exhibit know nothing about the Los Angeles music scene. And we just want to say, we are aware that there are bands that are not on the wall that would be nice to have. We are digging through our own in-house mine, shall we say. These are Herald Examiner and Gary Leonard photos. It's what we have. So in the spirit of just serendipity and looking through boxes and finding things and thinking, yes, I don't know who Brunette are, but they look great. You know, in that spirit, we present this exhibit. And for those people who are going to fold their arms and are going to scowl because the germs aren't up there, although we do have a Darby Crash portrait in the book, but you know what I mean. It's something for everyone, and we hope that people get it, that it is an exhibit for everybody, for every kind of music. It's just really about, hey, look at this cool picture. That's really all we're trying to say.
It's not meant to be like a definitive study of the music scene. It's these really cool photos that we have. And no, guys, we really didn't have any photos of Poison in the collection. We really didn't.
Okay, Christina, you've already signed off. Wendy, you just took us home. You brought us to the door, and I want you just to say goodbye to everyone.
Well, everybody, we hope you come and see us. Goodbye for now, but come and visit us. We'd love to have you.
My name is Anastasia Lukairos Sideris. I'm in the Laskin School of Public Affairs, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
And we're done. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to our podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of February 23rd, 2015. Our guests this week were George Red Fox. He's president of Downey Conservancy, and he was here to talk to us about saving Taco Bell number one. Save Taco Bell is that their hashtag. We also spoke with librarians Christina Rice and Wendy Horowitz from LAPL Central about their exhibit, From Pop to the Pit, LAPL Photo Collection Celebrates the Los Angeles Music Scene from 1978 to 1989. We like feedback. Kim, tell us how people can get into the feedback loop with us.
There are so many ways, but they all come down to the personal touch. You can send us an email at youcanteatthesunshine@gmail.com or through the contact link at www.esoteric.com. You can join us on an esoteric bus adventure, and that is kind of the reason we're here. We give bus tours, so get on the bus and come and tell us you listen to the podcast. That's always fun. You can also join us at one of the lava events that Richard and I host, as, for example, the forensic science seminars at Cal State LA or the Lava Sunday Salons. We are always so glad to see and hear from you. You can also, if you're listening to this podcast through a podcatcher or caster of some sort, like, for instance, iTunes or Stitcher, you can rate the show and let people know that you're listening there. We also appreciate your reviews. Thanks so much for listening and letting us know what you think.
Okay, Kim, you're gonna take us home. This is the exit. This is where you bring us up to speed on some upcoming bus tours. And please take it away.
Allow me to tell you of what is coming up in your future and in ours. February 28th, we get back on the crime bus tip with Wild Wild West Side, starting downtown, of course, and heading due west to Santa Monica, Venice, land of cults, land of child abuse, land of cult priestesses carried away and held like the precious gems that they are, and all the weirdos who got into trouble underneath the pier and when taking too much LSD. All my favorite people, in other words. That's a fun tour. It hasn't been on our calendar in a while, but it's back, and on that bus you'll also learn about how I, as a very small toddler child, not only crashed a vintage MG automobile, but faked my own kidnapping. It's always fun when a little bit of true Kim history slips into these crime bus tours. You'll understand why I do the work I do if you get on that bus. On March the 7th, it's Weird West Adams, a tour of the many neighborhoods that flank the 10 freeway, neighborhoods filled with crime and peculiarity and very beautiful architecture, and also one of the oldest cemeteries in the West, and also some very interesting lore about getting rid of the racist housing covenants, not only in Los Angeles, but nationwide, that have allowed some of our neighborhoods to become more mixed in years since. So that is always an interesting tour, and we're always happy to see a lot of West Adams residents on that bus. It is one of the more house-proud and history-proud communities that we know about, and it's that's a cool thing. People love their West Adams, whatever part of West Adams they live in. We've got March 14th off, but on March the 21st, you'll find us in Pasadena for Pasadena Confidential with Crimebo the Clown, a tour about rocket science, black sex magic, presidential assassins, suicide jumpers, rose queens, and did I mention the architecture? I don't think I did, but it being Pasadena, there are some real gems on that tour. And, of course, Crimebo, who is more like a painted hobo than a clown. He's our guest. And Crimebo is very, very fun and sweet, and you will like him. But if you don't like clowns, you can sit in the back of the bus. At the end of March, we're debuting a brand new bus adventure. It's called Hollywood, with an exclamation point. And this is a tour about a community I grew up in. And these are the things that fascinate me about Hollywood. I found some crimes that I didn't know about before that I think are really iconic, baffling, bizarre, and fascinating cases, and I'm really looking forward to debuting them on this tour. We'll also be taking you through some extraordinary historic locations. We'll have a walk through Crossroads of the World, which of course was built as a memorial to a murdered husband, and we'll take you through the Chateau Elysee, which also was built as a memorial to a murdered husband. Some of the best architecture in LA was. And, yeah, if you like my true crime tours, you're going to dig Hollywood. If you like architecture, you're going to dig Hollywood. If you like Hollywood, you're going to dig Hollywood. So get on the bus. That's March 28th. April the 11th, it's Hotel Horrors and Main Street Vice, a downtown double feature about the very cool, very lost, very dangerous, deadly, and beautiful downtown that was. B-girls, burlesque queens, serial killers, beautiful hotels, trouble on the hoof. That's a fun tour, and it's always very popular. And speaking of popular tours, we're already about half full on our next Real Black Dahlia tour, Richard. That is on April the 18th. It is our most popular crime bus tour, the tour that asks not who killed Beth Short, although we talk about it, who couldn't, but why we should care about the victim in what remains the most notorious and celebrated unsolved murder case in L.A. history. We're going to really just soak up the energy of 1947 L.A., that post-war city of strangers rubbing up against each other, getting into some wonderful situations and some terrible ones, as Beth Short did. And we're wrapping up the month of April with another new tour on the calendar, Echo Park Book of the Dead. A lot of really strange and delightful, delicious, odd crimes in that lovely streetcar suburb, and a tour of the evangelist sister Amy Semple McPherson's gorgeous house museum, which does have, if I may say so, and I've seen some goodies, the most beautiful bathroom in Los Angeles. And no, you can't use it, but you can look at it. And of course, well, everyone always wants to use it, Richard. And, of course,
they have a bathroom downstairs.
That's a pretty bathroom, too, but it's not sister's shower. And, of course, in May. May 16th, is it, darling?
Yes.
Love of my life, yes. The Tom Waits tour is back. Our once-a-year bus adventure with David Smay in the footsteps of the singer-songwriter Tom Waits. So get on the bus. We love to see you.
Kim, thank you for bringing us home. I appreciate your continued efforts to help make this podcast the best podcast we can record. I want to thank everyone for listening to it. We sure do appreciate it. It means a lot to us. And I want to remind you,
you can't eat the sunshine.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Herbina Betweena.